A summer's day, the 23rd of August, 1913. The streets of the village are decked in bunting. Fir branches and oak roofs hang over the doorways and windows. Pictures and frames of uniform-clad men are turned from gazing into the darks of rooms to stare into the light outside. The streets and alleys are crowded with participants as the quaint town, beautifully situated, where little has happened in the last 100 years, comes alive with festivities. The summer had not been one of searing sun. Rain prior to this day was evoking of the past, 100 years prior, of the period those gathered had come to celebrate. It was mid-afternoon, when the sun, at its zenith, ought to be at its hottest. But rather, with the breeze, the temperature fluctuated around chilly 15 degrees. The men in the streets buttoned their blazers, and the women pulled close their shawls as they gathered upon the plats at the entranceway to the village. Throughout the early afternoon, the town had been abuzz. Restaurants were full as veterans, men in uniform, and others dressed down, their medal ribbons pinned to their lapels, drank merrily and recounted tales of their service. Outside, military bands filled the air with the rhythmic staccato beats of marchers, complemented by the sounds of boots stepping into line. But now they all gathered outside. On a stand beneath a marquee, representatives had gathered. Adolf von Achenbach, the administrator of the local Teltow district, was joined by Regierungspräsident Rudolf von der Schulenburg. A thin man of ghostly white hair formed to a widow's peak. Head of the district municipality, Dr. Grosse, and the local priest, Parisius. In the square before the stand, Prussian regiments stood to attention. Once the clock struck 2:30, the eyes of all those gathered looked to the recently widened boulevard, lined with saplings, and that stretched north to the capital, Berlin. Orchestrated perfectly, a black automobile, roof down and occupants open to the overcast day above, approaches. The crowd stiffens. Whilst many had hoped the Kaiser and Prussian king himself might have made an appearance, he meanwhile was attending to some matters of state in the Mainz region. In his stead, the Kaiser had dispatched the man whom approached in the automobile, Prince Eitel Friedrich, the Kaiser's second son. Was more portly than his elder chain-smoking brother, the Crown Prince Wilhelm. His features were softer and his eyes more kind. Stepping from the automobile onto the square, the crowd went silent as the band struck up the imperial anthem. Greeted by the delegates already in attendance, Prince Eitel Friedrich shook hands and saluted accordingly. Then all heads bowed as Pastor Parisius made a short speech. Following the pastor, scouts were then paraded, and then Count Bülow von Dennewitz made his speech as the prince listened on. It was hard for all those in attendance to truly listen as the eyes took priority over the ears, for above all those gathered towered a new monument, 30 meters in height and decorated with sculpture. The tower rose majestically. Held into its side, the Iron Cross, the ribbon of which many of those gathered wore upon their chests or through buttonholes. The dates, 1813 to 1913, cast in bronze above and below. For over 50 years, the tower's memorial purpose had been celebrated. For over 50 years, the people of this provincial village, as well as the people of Prussia and Europe, remembered the name Großbirn. With the events of 1870, the uniting of the German kingdoms had seen the splendor of the day fade. But on this day, the 23rd of August 1913, the name would stand aloud once again as the people of Prussia remembered the Battle of Großbieren.
Achtung, Achtung. Hier ist die Sendestelle Berlin. Im Volkshaus. Meine Damen und Herren.
Welcome to Achtung History. a podcast produced and presented by myself, Simon J. James. This week, the Battle of Grosbeeren. Berlin had been liberated by the French's own retreat in the midst of the night of the 3rd of March 1813. On the morning of the 4th, the people of Berlin awoke to find their city's gates wide open. Then arrived the Russian Cossacks, amongst them the Prussians, who had resolved to keep the fight for their country rather than to stand meekly as a vassal for the French dictator Napoleon. To understand the fight for Berlin further, I recommend our previous episode, Liberation and Death. The recapture of Berlin, the Prussian capital, had for the Prussian monarch Friedrich Wilhelm III forced his oft-wavering hand into action. On the 17th of March, he issued his appeals to his nation. With "Ein mein Volk," Friedrich Wilhelm turned to the people, noted from his residence in Breslau, the people of Brandenburg, Prussia, Silesia, Pomerania, and Litauen. It in part read,
"This is the last decisive struggle we are engaged in for our existence, our independence, our prosperity. There is no other way but an honourable peace or a glorious downfall. You too would confidently look forward to this for the sake of honour, because the Prussian and the German cannot live without honour. We alone may trust with confidence. God and our firm will give victory to our just cause, and with it a sure and glorious peace and the return of a happy time."
He looked towards a future resurgent Prussia that would be one that supported freedom of conscience, honor, independence, trade, art, industry, and science. Within this, a new army was to be formed, a people's army, raising the men of the nation to cast Napoleon's tyranny from the German soil. Friedrich Wilhelm knew it was to be a difficult struggle. Napoleon, even in his disastrous retreat from Russia, was still a formidable foe, not to be underestimated. Therefore, in order to spur on the men of his nation, he put pen to paper and drew out a new decoration that would be hung to the chests of the brave men who marched into battle under the Prussian standard. On this, the great architect of Prussia, Karl Friedrich Schinkel, received a note from the king.
"His Royal Majesty has decided to allow a special award of merit to appear for the duration of the present war. It is said to consist of a black cast iron cross set in silver, the front of which remains completely smooth and without any inscription, but the reverse side at the top contains the signature FW with the crown. In the middle, three oak leaves, under the year 1813. His Majesty has designed the attached drawing of it themselves and wishes a clean drawing."
The Iron Cross was born. On this day of "An mein Volk," of the Iron Cross, the Russian Tsar, Alexander I, also arrived at the premises of the king. And now the king, Friedrich Wilhelm III, would officially declare war on France. The war of liberation had begun. In France, however, Napoleon had not sat upon his withered laurels. Rather the opposite. Prussia's fall had only enacted him to plan for the reconquest of the kingdom. Having compelled his allies, or the territories which he had conquered, to produce the fighting men necessary for the Russian invasion, he had been able to preserve much of the French fighting-aged men. The Dutch, Germans, Austrians, Italians, and especially the Poles had suffered greatly, as had 300,000 French men in the failed invasion of Russia. But Napoleon still had plenty in reserve in France. In 1811 and 1812, fearing that as he marched into Russia, the states he had conquered might attempt a resurrection against France, Napoleon had founded the National Guard. Formed to only be a national defense, it still saw to training its troops. and now these half-trained soldiers were marching toward the Elbe, less than a fortnight after Friedrich Wilhelm had declared war. And it was with the renewal of spring that the forces of the two sides, those of the French and those of the ever-growing coalition, drew closer together. Napoleon, on his arrival in Erfurt on the 25th of April, found his troops in the following positions. Eugene, Napoleon's stepson, rode with Marshal Jacques Macdonald, General Lauriston, and Rainier's corps on the Lower Saale. Marshal Ney was positioned before Weimar. The Imperial Guard stood with Napoleon at Erfurt, whilst Marshal de Marmont was at Gotha, General Bertrand at Saalfeld, and Marshal Oudinot at Coburg. Together, and in typical fashion, the troops of the French then began their march forward. The front, the advance guard, marching in lines, whilst the rear, two-thirds of the forces, moved as one mass toward Leipzig. The Prussian and Russian forces had hastily managed to bring together an opposing force, equally numbering 200,000, but lacking in much the skill and training that their French opponents held. They feared that Berlin was once again to be the object of Napoleon's eye, and thus had established a series of outposts that would act as an early warning system near Magdeburg on the Elbe. Meanwhile, the bulk of the coalition forces were marching down the Elbe toward Dresden, from which the forces under the command of Russian General Peter Wittgenstein hoped they might then turn and effectively roll up Napoleon's forces along the Elbe. On the 1st of May, Napoleon marched into Lützen, where the great Gustavus Adolphus of Sweden had fallen in battle in 1632. Upon the hearing of this news, Wittgenstein believed it was the sum of the French forces and not an advance guard, and therefore ordered an attack. At 9 on the morning of the 2nd, Wittgenstein ordered the attack, yet it did not come. It was 11:30 in the morning by the time that Gebhard von Blücher received the order and began the attack. The coalition's information provided to von Blücher was quickly realized to be inadequate. Expecting a few thousand enemy soldiers, Blücher advanced toward Großgürschen to Lützen's southeast. Yet it was a full division that awaited him. Over 10,000 men of the enemy stood in his way. Reacting swiftly, Blücher cried halt to the attack, instead ordering his artillery to be brought forth, and began a bombardment at around midday. The sounds of the cannon fire echoed across the countryside and brought the attention of Marshal Marmont, who moved his troops to Stasidel, directly west of Großgürschen. For 40 minutes, Blücher bombarded Großgürschen before sending in a brigade to drive the French out. Small successes followed. Kleingürschen and Rana were cleared of the French, but soon Marshal Ney reacted and launched a counterattack that quickly drove Blücher and his troops back. Blücher committed his last troops from reserve and succeeded in retaking the positions, but he fell injured in the fighting and had to hand command to General von York, whose actions at Tarogen had begun the Prussian resistance to Napoleon. Alerted by the cannon, Napoleon, whom had been conducting a battlefield sightseeing tour from memory for his officers of the Battle of 1632, in which Gustavus Adolphus had fallen, had arrived at 2 in the afternoon and quickly acted upon the situation with the lightning decisions for which he was famous, providing Ney with a stream of reinforcements which were in turn placed in the villages around Lützen. At 4, York committed the Prussian reserves, and along with Wittgenstein, they pressed Marshal Ney. Back and forth, the villagers changed hands between the coalition and French forces. Even Friedrich Wilhelm III, at the front of a formation of the Prussian Guard, led a charge into the battle and took Rana. At 5:30, it appeared that the coalition had won the day, holding control of all the villages bar that of Kaya, which was still in the midst of battle. Then, as luck would have it for the French, Bertrand and Macdonald's corps arrived. With the coalition held, Napoleon lashed out. For the coalition forces in the villages, the cannon sounded like the great rolls of summer thunder. Napoleon had gathered 100 guns and unleashed them upon the villages, a barrage of cannon fire that was devastating. Wittgenstein's troops at the center were torn, and through the falling clouds of dust, Napoleon's Imperial Guard marched, clearing the villages as they went. By nightfall, and with word that Leipzig had fallen, Wittgenstein and Tsar Alexander withdrew orderly from the field of battle. Napoleon, unable to follow due to lack of cavalry, had won the day, but lost almost 20,000 men killed or wounded, whilst the coalition forces lost 8,500 of their own. Pushed by Napoleon, the coalition army, outnumbered and licking its wounds, withdrew eastwards. It was upon reaching Bautzen that Tsar Alexander and King Friedrich Wilhelm ordered their troops under Wittgenstein and Blücher to halt. Together, they boasted 100,000 men. But Napoleon, who was gaining fast, had 115,000, and Marshal Ney a further 85,000 within easy marching distance. Wittgenstein formed the defense along the River Spree. Making use of the landscape, he anchored the right flank with a number of lakes and the left with the town of Bautzen itself. Before this, a holding line of villages. Napoleon had planned a trap. Hold the Prussian and Russian forces to their lines, then make use of Marshal Ney's forces in a sweeping maneuver that would decimate the forces of the coalition. Napoleon began, once again, with the artillery bombarding the coalition lines. Following the forces of the French Emperor's advance, Bautzen fell, as did the villages of the holding line. Falling back, the Prussians and Russians had become aware of the presence of Ney and his attempt to cut off their line of retreat. But Ney somehow became confused and left the door open, allowing the coalition to retreat once again and in good order. On the next day, the fighting continued. On this day, it seemed at first that the battle was going the way of the coalition. But soon Napoleon turned the setbacks around and began an advance on his enemy's lines. Ney, at this point, made his second mistake of the battle. Distracted, he advanced on a small village, seizing it, but in doing so, he had forgotten his purpose of cutting off a line of retreat, a retreat that was called at 4. Once again, the battle had cost Napoleon at least 20,000 men, to estimates of between 11 and 20,000 on the opposing side. Napoleon's forces had greatly been weakened, although he had gained victories upon the battlefield. But the crushing defeat of the coalition forces still eluded him. On the 2nd of June, the Allies requested a limited truce, to which Napoleon agreed on the 4th. During the truce, Alexander and Friedrich Wilhelm met with the Swedish Crown Prince Charles Jean, otherwise known as Napoleon's former marshal, Bernadotte. Bernadotte, as an ally, was to be vital if they were to defeat Napoleon. He not only knew Napoleon's tactics, but had been an active part in them, and at Trachenberg Castle, they coordinated the war effort. The strategy was a Fabian one. Avoid direct conflict with Napoleon. Engage with his marshals wherever possible and encircle the French with three independent armies cornering the French Emperor. The three armies were as follows. The Army of Silesia formed of 95,000 Russians and Prussians under von Blücher. The Army of the North of Swedes, Russians, Prussians and German troops of Mecklenburg and the Hanseatic regions numbering 135,000 under Bernadotte. And finally, 225,000 Austrians and Russians under the command of Prince Karl von Schwarzenberg, but overseen by the three monarchs, Alexander, Friedrich Wilhelm, and Francis. The truce that was supposed to last until the middle of July was extended into the autumn as all licked their wounds. During the treaty, Wittgenstein's deputy, the Prussian general and chief of the Prussian staff, Gerhard von Scharnhorst, died of wounds sustained in the Battle of Lützen. During this period, Napoleon withdrew his troops, centering his troops in the Saxon towns of Bautzen and Görlitz. He oversaw a steady stream of reinforcements that brought not only a stronger physical fibre, but also a moral one to the French cause. He was determined to strike out, to launch an attack on Berlin, and from there spring forth with continued momentum to seize the fortresses at Köstrin, Stettin, and at Danzig. And at Berlin, Napoleon learned his former general Bernadotte was positioned with his Army of the North. Knowing Bernadotte, Napoleon carefully considered his generals and chose Oudinot to be an ample opponent. With the ending of the truce on the 10th of August, Napoleon sprung into action, ordering Oudinot's forces north toward Berlin. Napoleon himself remained waiting to see what his enemies would do. Oudinot advanced north with the personal orders of Napoleon in his pocket, which read,
"Should Berlin resist, have the city set on fire by projectiles."
There was not to be a march into Berlin, as there was when the city first fell to the French in 1806. Napoleon made it clear. Berlin was to be destroyed. Yet Berlin, not knowing the orders of the French emperor, and even if the people were aware, it was unlikely they were to turn meekly to those whom had occupied the Prussian capital for over 6 years. Besides, Bernadotte was present with his Army of the North, and since the spring, the city had been preparing. Knowing that Berlin was likely to be the object of Napoleon's obsessions, an obtainable goal unlike that of Moscow, the people of Berlin had dug entrenchments around the south of the city and on the surrounding heights. Strategic positions at the Tempelhofer Berg had been taken up, also near Schöneberg and at the Kölnische Weinberge. With double zeal, the workers, the people, the army pressed forth with the fortifications that would defend their city should the French get so far. Bernadotte apparently never found favour with the Berliners. A newspaper from 1913 wrote,
"Unfortunately, it, the defence force, was led by the Crown Prince Karl Johan of Sweden, the French former swashbuckler, who, in the Council of Allies, was believed to be entrusted with this high position for political reasons, but who had not the slightest interest in vigorously confronting the enemy, who was even determined to retreat across the Spree without a rush of swords, and for this purpose had already had a bridge built across the Spree at Moabit."
At a war council, at the small manor in Philippsthal, to the southwest of Berlin, Bernadotte clashed bitterly with the Prussian generals Bülow and Tauentzien. Both of the Prussian generals favoured an all-out attack, something which Bernadotte was very resistant to do, and both were less than impressed with Bernadotte's attitude towards Berlin. In the council meeting, Bernadotte exclaimed,
"Eh bien, what is Berlin? Berlin is a city."
Bülow, riled by Bernadotte's blasé nature and dismissal of Berlin, replied,
"Berlin is the capital of Prussia, and my troops and I will make no use of that bridge. Our bones shall bleach before Berlin, not behind it."
Bülow, determined as he was, finally brought Bernadotte to an agreement that the forces would ride out and meet those of Oudinot before he reached the defences of Berlin. 8 days after his departure, with the ending of the truce, Oudinot was advancing at a steady pace toward Berlin. On the 18th, he united his army amidst the forests near the town of Bayreuth. Ahead, however, lay the broad, marshy belts of the Noth and the Nutter rivers that slowed their passage. By the 20th, Oudinot and his forces of 70,000 men had reached Zossen and Trebin, both small towns occupied by Prussian defenders placed to slow the French assault. For 2 days, they pestered the French and put up countless acts of resistance. From Melun, Wittstock, Thiroux, and at Funsdorf, the Prussian forces hampered the French, never truly meaning to attack, but rather to nip at their heels. All whilst the main army formed into its positions that stretched from Güttergross to Marlow and Blankenfeld in a large arc. Bernadotte had taken the right wing between Güttergross and Rohlsdorf. Bülow was at the centre, in front of Heinersdorf, and Tauentzien on the left wing, south of Marlow. Now the Prussian men whom had been placed in the small towns withdrew and allowed Oudinot to advance. By the evening of the 22nd, Oudinot, as the left flank, had reached Ahrensdorf. The centre under Count Rainier was between Wittstock and Leuvenbruck, whilst the right flank under Bertrand was nearing Funsdorf. For in August, the weather was heavy with rain. The ground had been saturated with water, and it made a rapid advance difficult, even more so for the lack of cavalry. All operations were hampered by the rainfall, and naturally would also have dampened the mood of the soldiers already nervous for the battles that they knew lay ahead. There was little to no dry patch of ground to rest on, and the supply lines dwindled. Come the morning of the 23rd, the French forces were once again on the move and moving toward the coalition forces. Whilst Oudinot remained south of Ahrensdorf, Bertrand was advancing on the right toward Blankenfeld, where he met the forces under Tauentzien. A brief moment of battle broke out as the forces collided, the French pushing against the Prussians whom had held their lines. Momentum soon dropped, and by noon the French forces had paused as Bertrand contented himself in observing the enemy. Meanwhile, it was only as the fighting on the right flank stagnated that Rainier in the centre began his own movements, leaving the overnight positions only at midday. Through the Genshagener Heide, a thick band of forest, Rainier and his divisions marched carelessly, the sodden ground tiring the forces and further disheartening the soldiers, whom were only kept warm by the thought of warm fires in the inns of Berlin once captured. At 4 PM, Rainier's troops reached Grossbieren, a hamlet of little more than 20 houses. Grossbieren was occupied by the Prussian forces, numbering just 62, under Major Ferdinand Friedrich von Zandrat. Zandrat launched a short battle, but quickly withdrew his troops to Heinersdorf, where Bülow was waiting. Rainier, believing the day's activities were done, had his men settle down and set their bivouacs for a night in Grossbieren. Bülow, upon hearing von Sandrart's report, set his men to action. Soon, 40,000 Prussian soldiers were mobilized to counter Rainier's advance. Bülow had the guns brought to the Windmühlenberg, to the town's northwest, and it was from here that the batteries of artillery began the Prussian attack. For an hour and a half, the artillery shelled the French. Then once the big guns fell silent, the soldiers advanced. A brigade formed of the Kolberg Infantry Regiment, 9th Reserves Infantry, 1st Mark Landwehr Infantry, and the 1st Pommern Cavalry launched the attack at the centre under Kraft, joined by Hesse-Homburg's 3rd Brigade of the 2nd East Prussian Grenadier Battalion, 3rd East Prussian Infantry Regiment, 4th Reserves Infantry, 3rd East Prussian Landwehr Infantry, and the 1st Hussars. Thurmann's 4th Brigade of the 4th East Prussian Infantry, the 5th Reserves Infantry, Elbe Infantry, East Prussian Jägers, and Pommern Hussars made up the right flank, whilst the bulk of the army stood back under Bernadotte before Stahnsdorf. A rearguard action ensued as the troops of the Prussians marched forward into Grossbieren, advancing on the French soldiers. It was as the 4th Reserves of the 3rd East Prussian Infantry Regiment under Hesse-Homburg advanced that they realized that during the day's rain, the powder which they had been given for their rifles had become damp and refused to fire. Continuing their advance, they turned their rifles around, advancing with the butts forward. From the front, one of the reserves cried, "Hakatau, es geht fort Vaterland." Strike for the Fatherland. Into battle, they advanced screaming, swinging their butts with a strong grip on the barrel. The butts came crashing into the faces of the French that opposed them. Soon these soldiers became known as the Hakatawa, and they would continue their call on entering battle, Hakatau, until the regiment was disbanded after the First World War. At the churchyard, the Kolberg Infantry Regiment met the French and a bloody battle ensued. Here, amongst the graves, the soldiers fell in their highest numbers. Yet it was not only the French whom fought. Saxons were present in support of the French. On the east of Grossbeeren, Thurman encountered the Saxon battalion Speer and promptly defeated it in battle. This allowed Thurman to advance on Grossbeeren and pursue Saxons under the command of General von Saar as part of the 7th Corps of the Grand Armée, up the Windmühlenberg. On the Saxon troops, the Landwehr advanced screaming, "So flush that bitter, this is how it goes." Soon the Saxons, as well as a division under Durette of French punishment soldiers, began to retreat. Panic fills the other soldiers as Oudinot's forces and many begin throwing their rifles into the muddy and bloody ground as they run back toward the Genshagener Heide, where amongst the trees in the dark of the night, they were in for a night of horror, as, like the retreating troops of Napoleon and Russia were, they were picked off one by one. As the foot troops retreated, the cavalry of both sides engaged in a flurrying display. Oudinot had heard the cannons fire from his position at Arensdorf. He had sent General Fournier forward with his cavalry division in the direction of Grossbeeren. But the Prussian Leibhufaren, Uhlans, and Dragoons were vigilant, and in a wild daze, they flooded up to Heinersdorf and back, causing the French onslaught to flag. When the day came to a close, Rainier's troops were in complete disarray. 3,000 Saxons and Frenchmen had perished in Grossbeeren. 14 French guns had been lost and would not be easily replaced, but they would be turned around upon them. But the Prussians were not without their own loss. 1,100 men died in the name of the first victory over Napoleon in the War of Liberation. A few days later, on the 27th of August, a French corps that was to operate in cooperation with Oudinot from Magdeburg was almost destroyed at Hagelberg on the Flemig, and Berlin, most importantly, was saved. From Berlin, a deputation of the city authorities went to Bernadotte's camp to congratulate him on his victory. None thought to go to the real victor of battle, von Bülow, whom, to his staff, stated,
"I'm glad that we did everything alone."
On the 6th, frustrated Napoleon dispatched Marshal Ney to again advance on Berlin. This time, the French were defeated at Dennewitz, allowing for the march of the coalition on Leipzig, where the greatest land battle in history until this point was to take place in the form of the Battle of Nations. The Battle of Grossbeeren was a small victory by numbers, but a great victory by morale and tactic. Although the Prussians would be frustrated by Bernadotte's resistance to seize the day and follow up with an all-out battle with Oudinot, the probability that such a response could be fielded was slim, especially with such little cavalry and drawing away from supply lines. Whilst Bernadotte gained the praise, which may have indeed been for political reasons, his tactics were sound. Engaging Napoleon in a full frontal onslaught would have been playing to Napoleon's tactical strengths. A continuation of the small engagements would lead slowly to the Battle of Nations, when the might of the coalition came to face that of Napoleon's Grand Armée. A battle that took a far superior numbers overwhelm Napoleon's tactical advantage. So, in 1913, a great tower was erected and opened by the Kaiser's second son, Prince Eitel Friedrich, to much fanfare. But why? When the battle's memory had become overshadowed by the wars of unification, was such a great memorial being opened now? Was it only to mark the centenary of the battle, or did it mean something else, something greater for Germany? I posed the question to German historian and author Katia Hoyer, and she was kind enough to answer thus.
The Napoleonic Wars became a firm part of Germany's foundation myth. As a brand new state, it desperately needed some form of heritage as a platform to create national sentiment, social cohesion, and loyalty towards the Kaiser and the government in Berlin. The Liberation Wars, as they were called, made ideal material for this because they could be sold as a pan-German effort against a common enemy. Some of the Freikorps already viewed it like that at the time and talked of the idea of a Fatherland, as opposed to their individual German states. But it was certainly idealized and became legendary. Großbieren is a good example, as it was directly linked with the defense of Berlin, i.e. the German capital, by the time the memorial was built. But the most prominent example is the Völkerschlachtdenkmal in Leipzig. The fact that the phrase Liberation Wars was much more common than Napoleonic Wars in itself says a lot about the angle this took in Germany.
As for Großbieren today, the town is slightly larger. It stretches to the slight rise where Schinkel would build a small church, and before it a similar in style memorial to that of the Kreuzberg that stands in Berlin, only in miniature. On the Muhlenberg, a pyramid was eventually erected in memory of von Bülow, the victor of the day, and at the center, the magnificent tower still stands and offers its views across the countryside, over the Teltower district, towards Potsdam and Berlin. On my own personal recommendation, visit the tower and support its continued operation. Visit, in my opinion, as I have done many times before, preferably by bicycle, then cycle to one of my favorite locations, Schloss Diedersdorf, and enjoy the magnificent beer garden. A special and heartfelt thanks goes out to Katia Hoyer for her wonderful input on this episode. Her book, Blood and Iron, The Rise and Fall of the German Empire, 1871 to 1918, is available now. A further thanks goes out to the Achtung History Patreons, Mitglieder Banks, Oberbürgermeisters Coleman and Munnerly, and Minister President Charles Kay. Thank you again for your continued support. Thank you for listening to the Achtung History Podcast. This has been the Battle of Großbieren. If you have enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving a rating and a review on whichever podcast service that you subscribe to. If you want to further support the Achtung History Podcast, you can do so via Patreon at patreon.com/Achtung History, where tiers begin for as little as €1, and all of the money goes back into producing this podcast. For further updates and for interesting on this day events, follow Achtung History on Twitter with the handle at Achtung History. From me, Simon J. James, until next time, goodbye.